We're holding in Igelt of Shiraigon. Ve'achsinu l'Rebbe min Shmaya. We had just seen the Gemara about tips on how to learn and succeed in learning. We had seen the Gemara about the hearts of the earlier generations being wide like the entrance to the Ulam, and the later generations like the hearts of the Heichal. And then we evolved, we saw the continuation of that Gemara about why David was more successful in learning than Shaul, that David would always offer others to learn what he learned. He was very forthcoming, he was happy to share his knowledge. And Shaul, although he was on a great level, he was more retained. He wasn't so forthcoming, and that's why that Shaul, it says, "Uvchol asher yaseh yarshia," that people appreciated who he was, but the growth of learning around him didn't flourish as much as by David.
Is it not connected?
I think it is connected, but I think that whatever I'll tell you will be my understanding. So I'd rather leave the question hanging. But what we can see a little bit is some Mefarshim write, and then you decide if you want to connect your question with this Medrash. I don't know if it's true to connect it or not. Some Farshim write that we see that when Shaul became king, he was hiding from the level of hiding from honor. And after he became king, so he fought for his honor. He was willing to kill David, kill out the city of Novi Rakoanim, rather than the throne being taken from him. So part of it, if not all of it, is attributed to depression that attacked Shaul towards the end of his life. But part of it is defined by the Mefarshim in David's answer to Shaul's daughter. When, after Shaul dies and David becomes king and he's dancing before the Aron, so Shaul's daughter comes out to greet him and says, "How honorable is it that the king of Israel dances like one of the laymen before the Aron?" And David tells her, "God chose me over your father's house because I am willing to forego my honor in honor of God." So the honor is not a question of my honor. As much as I honor God, that's honorable I am. That's the only honor that exists for me. And the Mefarshim say that this, to an extent, summarizes a difference between Shaul and David. That David's modesty was internal and was an amazing trait, and it's what saved his life and it's what caused him to be king. But at some point, it was off. It wasn't exactly the way it should have been. Then whether these two points are connected or not, that's, I don't know. We have to see Chazal connected. So Rav Shiragon is telling us they gave Rebbe extra strength, that he had Torah Ugdula. And this, he's quoting a Gemara in Gittin. The Gemara in Gittin, Daf Nun Tes Amud Aleph, says the following. Rama Rabba Brei de Rava. Rava named his son Rabba. Rava's Rebbe was Rabba. That's interesting that really Rava and Rabba are both nicknames. They both had the same name, Rabbi Abba. And they made it short. They made one Rabba, he was the older generation. And the younger one they made Rava. And now Rava names his son, presumably after his Rebbe, Rabba. So Rabba, the son of Rava, who was the disciple of Rabba, you guys with me? So Rabba, the son of Rava, says, and others quote in the name of Hillel, the son of Rebbe, Palis, from the days of Moshe until Rebbe, lo matzinu Torah ugdula makom echad. From the days of Moshe until Rebbe, we don't find Torah and greatness in one place. That there's no one greater in Torah and in wealth than this person. We had it with Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe started off poor, but ultimately he was the wealthiest Jew. And Rebbe. And in between, we never encountered such a thing. That someone will be the wealthiest and the greatest in Torah at the same time. Velo, so the Gemara automatically asks, no, really? We found Yoshua. Yoshua was Yoshua ben Nun. He was very, very wealthy, and he was also the greatest rabbi. So the Gemara says,
that there was Elazar, and Elazar was the great leader after Yeshua passed away, and he, so to speak, caused the shine of Yeshua, that it wasn't singular. There was Elazar present as well. So you can't say he was the greatest in his generation and there was no one close to him. No, there was Elazar. So Gemara says, wait, what about Elazar? Elazar was the great leader after Yeshua. So the Gemara says, there was Pinchas. Pinchas was still around, and he was approximately the same as Elazar. Vav Pinchas, but there was Pinchas. So when Elazar passed away, isn't Pinchas so alone? So the Gemara says, Abu Zkenim, there were the elders. Hahava Shaul, but Shaul, he was the king, he was the wealthiest, and he was the greatest rabbi in his time. Hava Shmuel, so Shmuel was around. Nanach Nafshe, but Shmuel passed away before Shaul passed away. So Shaul did have a period of a year maybe where he was the only great rabbi and he was the wealthiest Jew around. So the Gemara says, Kulushani Kamuinan. We meant someone who, throughout his days, he was the greatest, like Rebbe. Once Rebbe made it, he made it, he was the greatest. Shaul only had a year or so without Shmuel around. Ba'avid David, David, he was king, wealthiest man in the Jewish people, and he was the greatest rabbi. Have Ira Ya'iri, there was David's Rebbe. Ira Ya'iri, he was David's Rebbe, he was around. Va'anach Nafshe, Ira passed away in David's lifetime. So Gemara says, Kulushan Din, and again, we want someone who had this level of greatness throughout his life. Ha'avi Shlomo, but there was King Solomon, wealthiest, smartest. Gemara says, Ha'avi Shimi ben Gera, there was Shimi ben Gera around, his Rebbe. Va'akatle, Shlomo ultimately put Shimi to death when Shimi rebelled against the kingdom. So again, that nonetheless, throughout his days, he wasn't the only one. There was Chizkiah, so there was Shevna around. Shevna was killed again, but still there was a period when Chizkiah wasn't alone. What about Ezra? So the Gemara says Nehemiah was around. So the Gemara continues. Rav Acha, the son of Rava, a different son of Rava, says, I'll add to this, from Rebbe to Rav Ashi, we don't find Torah and greatness in Torah, greatness and wealth in one place, that one person will be the greatest in both. Gemara says, what about Huna Bar Natan? So Gemara says, no. Huna Bar Natan was subservient to Rav Ashi, so that doesn't count that he prevented the shine of Rav Ashi. So this Gemara tells us that one of the exceptional traits of Rebbe was that from Moshe Rabbeinu's time to Rebbe's time, there was no one who was the greatest in Torah and the greatest in wealth who had both the political leadership and the Torah leadership in one place. There was always a divide. And here, there was one person who had the greatest economic wealth, the greatest leadership, and the greatest Torah knowledge, and that was Rebbe. So Rebbe was given from heaven this blessing that he would be able to lead the Jewish people and compile the Mishnah. And the rabbis had peace from all attacks during the period of Rebbe, because of the special fondness that was between Antoninus and Rebbe. Antoninus was the head Roman, the Caesar, and he loved Rebbe. And the Gemara asks, did Antoninus ever become a ger? So we have many different quotes, discussions between Antoninus and Rebbe. Rebbe would come to Antoninus to teach him Torah. And Antoninus taught Rebbe certain things. Rebbe says that Antoninus was the one that taught me that a person has a Yetzer Hara from the time he's ready to be born. I felt differently, and Antoninus proved it to me from the Psukim. So the Gemara asks, did Antoninus ever become a ger? So the Gemara says, yeah, because after Antoninus had a bris milah, he came to Rebbe and said, I want you to check it out. Check out if my bris is kosher. So Rebbe said to Antoninus, I never looked at my own bris milah. You want me to look at yours? That's why Rebbe is called Rabbeinu HaKadosh. Rebbe is called Kodosh, the Holy One, because his hands never went beneath his belt and he never looked beneath his belt. That's a certain level of holiness. By the way, it's one of the things I do here at the Machon. I'm not Rebbe. I check people's Brit Milah for them. If you ever have a question whether it's kosher or not, so let me know.
How can you tell?
You check the scar. Usually you check scar. I mean, some people start pulling around to see exactly how it was cut, but usually it's enough by the scar. If it's borderline, so then sometimes you have to bring in another expert and figure it out. But no, I've done that. Sometimes
you
I
have like a whole group of guys like look at
the. No, I look. I take a guy into the office. We close the door for a second and I check. I say this because almost every month we have someone here who's in doubt whether his mila was kosher. Was it done by a Jewish doctor after 8 days, or a Jewish moel after 8 days old? And is it kosher? Did they cut enough?
Sometimes a person doesn't know. Almost always they cut enough. I don't remember the last time someone showed up where they didn't cut enough. Almost always the problem is that it wasn't a Jewish doctor, or it was done before 8 days. In hospitals in the United States, they very often do bris milah, like after 2 days, after 3 days. Here in Israel also, for Arabs, they'll do before they discharge an Arab baby. So many parents ask the doctors to do bris milah, and they'll do it 2 or 3 days after the baby's born. That's usually the more common problem that I encounter here at the Machon. Most people coming here have a kosher bris. Nowadays, this generation, people from who are older than you guys, 45, 50, 60, they had a bris milah, so then sometimes there are issues. But also, if they're coming from the United States, what I've encountered, I haven't encountered thousands yet, but the numbers I've encountered, most of them are kosher bris. The main issue is usually that it wasn't done either in the proper time, maybe it was done by night, then it's not a kosher bris, it has to be done by day, after the 8th day, by a Torah observant Jew, from the 8th day on. You could check that with your parents, find out where your bris milah was done, when and how. If it wasn't done properly, so then the procedure is nothing. There are guys here I could refer you to if you're scared. I did it and they didn't even know that it was done. Like one guy, no, when are you doing it? It's done, pick up your pants, it's over. It's really a second. So we said in Rebbe's time there was peace. They were able to sit and focus on their learning because there was a special relationship between Rebbe and Antoninus. To ask him and they agreed to start preparing that the laws of the Mishnah will be prepared and everyone will be able to review it with the same terminology, which is what we call the modern day Mishnah, as we discussed that. Prior to Rebbe's compilation of the Mishnah, everyone was taught in a different version. Each Rebbe used his way of expanding, of teaching the oral law. And people would have these shorthand versions of Mishnah. And when it came to Rebbe's time, he boiled it down to 13 primary versions that were around of the oral law. And Rebbe wanted to ensure that the Torah would remain. And this is one of the greatest historical insights that we find in our sages, that they were able to foresee that times would get worse. Prior to the destruction, the Institute of Things in Preparation, 100 years earlier, they already foresaw the destruction. And Rebbe sees that he has a time of peace. So most people, when things are going good, they assume it'll go good for generations. People always think, that's it, now we've reached a plateau, it's going to be good. The Jews in every country thought that. The Jews in Spain thought that. Today the Jews in the United States and Israel think that. So people always like to think it'll always be good. And one of the greatest wisdoms we see by our sages is that they were always looking to the future and saying, wait, we have no guarantee it'll get good. And sometimes they said, almost certainly it'll get bad. And Rebbe recognizes that this is a window in history in which they could sit down peacefully and regroup and boil it down to one version of oral law. And that's why Rebbe sits down with the sages and they start preparing the oral law, getting it down to one version. And the previous generations didn't need this because being that it's Torah Sheba'al Peh and the reasonings of the Torah Sheba'al Peh were just given over, everyone knew it. It wasn't something that needed to be written. So just like when you tell over your friend the story, you don't choose these words or those words, you just tell over the story. So too, the oral law was given over. And whenever they'd gather in the Lishkata Gazit, that's the place in the temple where the highest court was, or in any basement, everyone was ready to give over the oral law. And the previous generations had a situation where we had our own government. They weren't scared of learning Torah. And in Rebbe's time, it was reinstated that they have that they had peace. From heaven they assisted them that they had clarity like the Torah from Sinai, and they didn't have arguments. Everything was clear until Rebbe's time. And now we're going to quote a Gemara in Sanhedrin, which is one of the basic Gemaras that we have to know. This is really a Tosefta that the Gemara is quoting about the involvement of the oral law.
If there's anyone that wants, for future reference, copies of what we're quoting, the Gemaras, let me know. In the past, no one looked in but me. So I didn't bother printing it out, getting copies.
If everyone's going to follow, we'll have copies then. The Gemara says as follows. Amar Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi says the following. Mitchila lo ayum rubin machlokt b'Yisrael. Initially, there weren't many arguments among Israel. El abetin shel 71 yoshvim b'lishkat hagazit. The court that had 71 would sit in their special room on the Temple Mount, inside the temple, called Lishkat HaGazit, the room of cut stone. There were two other high courts, numbering 23, and one was sitting in the entrance to the Azara, and one was sitting in the entrance to the Temple Mount, to the Har HaBayis. And all the other courts of 23 would sit in the different cities in Israel. Anytime they had a question, so if the question, the court in the city didn't know, they'd ask the court in the city. If the court knew, they'd tell them. And if not, they'd come to the court that was near their city. And if the neighboring court didn't know, so then they'd go to the court that was at the entrance to Har HaBayis, the first high court. If they knew the answer, if they had a tradition on the answer, they'd tell them. And if not, they'd go to the court that was at the entrance to the Azara, still the second high court of 23. And then he'd tell them, this is what we thought, this is what our friends thought, what do you guys think? So if they had a tradition, they'd tell them. And if not, then all of them would come together to the highest court in the Lishkas HaGazis, the room of cut stone. And over there, they would sit from the morning sacrifice until the evening afternoon sacrifice throughout the day. And on Shabbos and Yom Tov, they'd sit outside. Any question that was asked between them, if they had a tradition, they'd tell them. And if not, then they'd take a vote, the high court. And if the opinion that said it should be impure won, so then they'd rule that in this case it should be impure. If the opinion that said it should be pure, they had the majority, so then the high court would rule it was pure. Misherabu Talmidei Shammai Vehilel Shelo Shimshu Kol Tzorkan. From the period that the disciples of Shammai and Hillel multiplied, and they did not serve their rabbis as much as they should have, they did not spend enough time studying before they went out teaching, Rabu Machloket B'Yisrael. There began a period where there was much argument within Israel, V'nasi Torah k'shtei Torot, and the Torah became like two Toros. Now what does it mean that there were many disciples of Hillel and Shammai that did not serve their Rabbim the way they should? So the Rambam explains that it means that the generations went down progressively. Each generation got more distance from Sinai, and when you're learning from a Rebbe, you learn from a Rebbe, you learn from a Rebbe, so slowly but surely the generations go down. And spiritually, explains the Rambam, the capacity for retention, the capacity for understanding went down, and we assume that every generation is less than the generation that preceded it, spiritually. So it reached a point where we hit the students of Shammai and Hillel where they went down so far that they were so distant from their predecessors that machlokas was rampant. They didn't have one tradition, they didn't have one way of understanding, they just weren't on the level that their predecessors were, and it reached a point where there was a lot of machlokas. The Rambam shifts the blame from the students of Hillel and Shammai to a spiritual occurrence. They went down in level. Rav Shiri Agon explains differently. Rav Shiri Agon seems to attribute the problems to the turbulence of the time. The bloodshed, the attacks from the enemies, the gzerot, the decrees against learning Torah in public, so that the rabbis just couldn't learn by their rabbis, by their teachers, the way their predecessors had. So it's true, he's learning simply, they did not serve their rabbis the way earlier generations had, but he's saying also that it wasn't their fault, but the occurrences of the time prevented them from being able to learn by their rabbim the way their predecessors had. V'rabanan debat arachi debimei Hillel v'rabban Shimon beno akati kashakli v'taru v'avu kaimin plugta detanai behade adadi v'lo ifshur luhul migrisinu v'pechad lashon achad. So the rabbis of the later generations, they
tried to figure out what the correct oral law was, but they'd have differences, they'd have disagreements. And they couldn't maintain one tradition on the oral law because they had different conclusions. Uviyomei de Rebbe, Ibn Osher Hashbag, and in the days of Rebbe, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel's son, Istaya Milta v'Tortzinu v'Katvinu. They had special help from heaven, and they were able to get it down pat and write it down. V'havu midi de matnitin k'moshe mipi ha'gvucha. And the words of the oral law of the Mishnah were clear as though Moshe were telling it over from God himself. It was something wondrous that they were able to get this. And they didn't invent their own version of the oral law, but they took the words of their predecessors and clarified them and wrote them down. How do I know this? So he brings an example. The Mishnah says, Maaseu badak ben zakai bo k'tzei teinim. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakai, Rabbi Yochanan the son of Zakai, the word Zakai means the one who found merits, he once had witnesses come before him, and they testified that someone killed someone. So he said, do you remember where the figs grow? The stem of the figs, do you remember how they were at the time of the murder? They were under a fig tree. Did you notice how the stems were? And one witness said they were one way, and the other witness said they were another way. And then he said, okay, once you two contradicted one another, your testimony isn't qualified. We have laws when we question witnesses, we could ask them any question. Sometimes they could say, we don't know. If we ask them, the guy who was murdering, did you notice what color yarmulke he's wearing? Under what tree he was standing? There are certain questions which they must know the answer. And there are certain questions which they could say, I don't know. But if they said, I don't know, so certain things won't disqualify their testimony. But if they say, I do know, and they contradict one another, that disqualifies their testimony. So we try to ask them as many questions as possible. And whatever they say, I don't know, fine. On many things, we'll accept an I don't know. Did you notice what color his shoes were? Were both his shoes tied? Was he wearing a tie? What color suit? We ask every question under the sun. Not every question under the sun. We have a list of questions, but we ask a lot of questions. And in this case, they couldn't stumble up the witnesses. So the man was going to be taken out to be killed. And then Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai asked, did you notice the fig tree, how the stems of the figs were? And the Gemara says, Mistabwa de ben Zakkai d'alma. The Gemara says, it must be, it's not Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, because all over he's called Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, and here the Mishnah just calls him son of Zakkai. So it's probably not him. The Gemara says, wait, can't be. We have another Tanakh source that says it was Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai who asked this question. So the Gemara answers that Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai was still a student, and he didn't have a right to ask any question of the witnesses, but he said, let's ask them this. And the rabbi said, ooh, that's a good idea, but he wasn't yet a rabbi. He was sitting there learning, and he had a good idea. So the rabbi said, fine. And then they implemented within the Mishnah, the rabbi said, not only am I going to accept what you said, but being that it worked to save the man's life, this question in cross-examination, so we're going to quote it in the Mishnah in your name, but you're not yet a rabbi. So in the Mishnah, it's called Ben Zakkai Seh, the son of Zakkai, which is really Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, only he wasn't yet a rabbi. So we see that from the time Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was a disciple of Hillel, till the time of Rebbe, this is the way the Mishnah was quoted. They were so accurate in their recording of the Mishnah that they remembered whether the Mishnah said ben Zakkai or Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, even though throughout Chas it doesn't say it. But over here, this one Mishnah was an exception, and the quote that we have is accurate. The rabbis were able to analyze why it was said this way and come up with the answer and give us the historical background as to why the Mishnah is quoted this way. Tov, we'll quote another quote. We have another 2 minutes. Yeah. So another proof is the Mishnah discusses how you make an Erev to a city and how do you take the outskirts of the city. So that's called Me'abrines Ha'arim. The Gemara says in Erev. And how are you Me'aber the cities? How do you figure out what part outside the city is included with the city? So Rebbe said, I want to know if this Mishnah should be quoted with an ayin, is it me'abrin, like Sfardi would say, or is it with an aleph, me'abrin? Let's go find out from the sons of Judah, who are very accurate, they have a very good tradition on the words that are used in the Mishnah. Let's make sure if we get it right, if it's with an aleph or an ayin. So we see that Rebbe himself, who quoted the Mishnah, he wasn't sure how the Mishnah was quoted. And when he wasn't sure about whether it's an Aleph or an Ayin, and the Gemara says that bottom line it has the same meaning. There aren't halachic differences. But nonetheless, Rebbe wanted to make sure, how should I quote it in the Mishnah? This way or this way? How is it going to be spelled? And the Gemara says that whichever way you quote it, you'll end up with the same understanding. So we see that this was the accuracy with which they quoted things. And when Rebbe got this quote of this Mishnah, the one who quoted it to him told him, there are some that say it this way, and there are some that say it this way. So Rebbe, whenever he'd review this Mishnah, would say, Ketzad me'abrin, ketzad me'abrin. And he maintained the mental note, I don't know if it's with an ayin or an aleph, there are two quotes to this Mishnah. And ultimately, Rebbe boiled it down to one correct version, but the accuracy with which the Mishnahs were given over was such that even on one letter, like aleph or ayin, Rebbe knew exactly how the Mishnah was supposed to be spelled, and if he didn't know, he knew that he didn't know. Any questions?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You said in the beginning, at this point, the trouble started because...
Oh.
So there said something about then.
So there was trouble in Hillel and Shammai's students' time, and that's why we have many of the machlokot that we have started then. A lot of the machlokot, and many of them revolve around how we deal with new questions. Now that we've learned the laws of inference, how do we apply them to new questions that arise? But Rebbe got the best version of Mishnah that he could get. Were there things that stemmed from a problem with Masorah? It seems there were. Because we see a Machlokes, Hillel and Shammai, how much you take off of Challah. And then you have testimony of two weavers that come into court and say, we have testimony that goes back to your rabbis, Shmaya and Naftali, on how much you take off, how much dough you have to make in order to be obligated in Challah. And all the rabbis accepted their testimony. So we see that there was some problem with the recording of how much it should be. Certain things it did affect, but what Rebbe did was he worked his way back to get the cleanest version he could get, and he had special siyata d'shmaya to be able to gather the rabbis together. Sometimes you have a question that arises and the rabbis don't know of a source to answer it, so they try to figure out the answer. And then someone comes in from a distance and he tells them, I have a tradition that such and such is the right answer. We're going to see later on that there was once a disciple learning by a rabbi, and he left him. And the rabbi met him a while later. He said, why'd you leave me? You think the other rabbi went to learn by is better? So he said, no, it's not that he's better. He just knows more Tanai quotes. When I ask you a question, you try to figure out with logic. And he knows the quote, the source. Your logic is sometimes right, sometimes wrong. If I bring you a Tanakh source, then you have to work out your logic differently. You have to say, well, I guess I got this wrong, I got that wrong. If I have a Tanakh quote, so then I know that that's the source. That's the way the halacha is supposed to be. So that's why when you have the sources, that's always better. Sometimes we have to use logic, so we use it as best as we can. But it seems that Rebbe did a good job of boiling it down. Rebbe, that's what Rav Shiragan is telling us, that he got he boiled it down to 13 versions, and among those 13 versions, his court ruled which ones we would go with. Rebbe Ubeis Dino.
That means today you're not referring to 13 different versions.
Well, we haven't yet discussed where do the Braisas fall in here. Braisa, Tosefta, we do have Tanai quotes, Braisa and Tosefta and Toros Kahanim, Medrash Halacha, that are not quoted in the Mishnah. And the question is, what strength do they have, and are they part of these other 12 versions that are not in our Shas Mishnah? So that we will get to later on, where those fall in.